New year, new life. The words moved me. I looked at Leela. She too was confused. She murmured, "We have to talk to my brother."
"Let me know."
"And the fireworks?"
"What do you mean?"
"We'll bring ours. And you?"
Stefano smiled. "How many fireworks do you want?"
"Lots." The young man again addressed me.
"Come to my house, and I promise you that we'll still be setting them off at dawn."
21. The whole way home we laughed till our sides ached, saying things like, "He's doing it for you."
"No, for you."
"He's in love, and to have you at his house, he'll invite even the communists, even the murderers of his father." "What are you talking about? He didn't even look at me." Reno listened to Stefano's proposal and immediately said no. But the wish to vanquish the Solaras kept him uncertain, and he talked about it with Pasquale, who got very angry. Enzo, on the other hand, mumbled, "All right, I'll come if I can." As for our parents, they were very pleased with that invitation, because for them, Don Achille no longer existed, and his children and his wife were good, well-to-do people, whom it was an honor to have as friends. Leela at first seemed in a daze, as if she had forgotten where she was, the streets, the neighborhood, the shoemaker's shop. Then she appeared at my house late one afternoon, with a look as if she had understood everything, and said to me, "We were wrong. Stefano doesn't want me or you." We discussed it in our usual fashion, mixing facts with fantasies. If he didn't want us, what did he want? We thought that Stefano, too, intended to teach the Solaras a lesson. We recalled when Michele had expelled Pasquale from Giliola's mother's party, thus interfering in the affairs of the Caracci's, and giving Stefano the appearance of a man unable to defend the memory of his father. On that occasion, if you thought about it, the brothers had insulted not only Pasquale, but also him. And so now he was raising the stakes, as if to spite them. He was making a conclusive peace with the Pelusos, even inviting them to his house for New Year's Eve. "And who benefits?" I asked Leela. "I don't know. He wants to make a gesture that no one would make here in the neighborhood."
"Forgive?"
Leela shook her head skeptically. She was trying to understand. We were both trying to understand. And understanding was something that we loved to do. Stefano didn't seem the type capable of forgiveness. According to Leela, he had something else in mind. And slowly, proceeding from one of the ideas she hadn't been able to get out of her head since the moment she started talking to Pasquale, she seemed to find a solution. "You remember when I said to Carmela that she could be Alfonso's girlfriend?"
"Yes."
"Stefano has in mind something like that."
"Marry Carmela?"
"More." Stefano, according to Leela, wanted to clear away everything. He wanted to try to get out of the before. He didn't want to pretend it was nothing, as our parents did, but rather to set in motion a phrase like,
"I know, my father was what he was, but now I'm here. We are us. And so, enough."
In other words, he wanted to make the whole neighborhood understand that he was not Don Achille, and that the Pelusos were not the former carpenter who had killed him. That hypothesis pleased us.
It immediately became a certainty, and we had an impulse of great fondness for the young Caracci. We decided to take his part.
We went to explain to Reno, to Pasquale, to Antonio, that Stefano's invitation was more than an invitation, that behind it were important meanings, that it was as if he were saying,
"Before us some ugly things happened. Our fathers, some in one way, some in another, didn't behave well. From this moment, we take note of that, and show that we children are better than they were.
Better?
Reno asked with interest. Better, I said. The complete opposite of the Saladas, who are worse than their grandfather and their father. I spoke with great excitement, in Italian, as if I were in school. Leela herself glanced at me in amazement, and Reno, Pasquale, and Antonio muttered, embarrassed. Pasquale even tried to answer in Italian, but he gave up. He said somberly,
His father made money on the black market, and now Stefano is using it to make more money. His shop is in the place where my father's carpenter shop was.
Leela narrowed her eyes, so you almost couldn't see them. It's true, but do you prefer to be on the side of someone who wants to change, or on the side of the Saladas?
Pasquale said proudly, partly out of conviction, partly because he was visibly jealous of Stefano's unexpected central role in Leela's words. I'm on my own side, and that's it.
But he was an honest soul. He thought it over again and again. He talked to his mother. He discussed it with the whole family. Giuseppina, who had been a tireless, good-natured worker, relaxed and exuberant, had become, after her husband's imprisonment, a slovenly woman, depressed by her bad luck, and she turned to the priest. The priest went to Stefano's shop, talked for a long time with Maria, then went back to talk to Giuseppina Peluso. In the end, everyone was persuaded that life was already very difficult, and that if it was possible, on the occasion of the new year, to reduce its tensions, it would be better for everyone. So, at 11:30 p.m. on December 31st, after the New Year's Eve dinner, various families, the family of the former carpenter, the family of the porter, that of the shoemaker, that of the fruit and vegetable seller, the family of Melina, who that night had made an effort with her appearance, climbed up to the fifth floor, to the old, hated home of Don Achille, to celebrate the new year together. 22. Stefano welcomed us with great cordiality. I remember that he had dressed with care. His face was slightly flushed because of his agitation. He was wearing a white shirt and a tie and a blue sleeveless vest. I found him very handsome, with the manners of a prince. I calculated that he was 7 years older than me and Leela, and I thought then that to have Gino as a boyfriend, a boy of my own age, was a small thing. When I asked him to come to the Caracci's with me, he had said that he couldn't, because his parents wouldn't let him go out after midnight. It was dangerous. I wanted an older boyfriend, one like those young men, Stefano, Pasquale, Reno, Antonio, Enzo. I looked at them. I hovered about them all evening. I nervously touched my earrings, my mother's silver bracelet. I had begun to feel pretty again, and I wanted to read the proof in their eyes. But they all seemed taken up by the fireworks that would start at midnight. They were waiting for their war of men and didn't pay attention even to Leela. Stefano was kind especially to Signora Peluso and to Melina, who didn't say a word. She had wild eyes and a long nose, but she had combed her hair, and with her earrings and her old black widow's dress, she looked like a lady. At midnight, the master of the house filled first his mother's glass with spumante, and right after that of Pasquale's mother. We toasted all the marvelous things that would happen in the new year. Then we began to swarm toward the terrace, the old people and children in coats and scarves, because it was very cold. I realized that the only one who lingered indifferently downstairs was Alfonso. I called him out of politeness, but he didn't hear me, or pretended not to. I ran up. Above me was a tremendous cold sky, full of stars and shadows.
The boys wore sweaters, except Pasquale and Enzo, who were in shirt sleeves. Lila and Ada and Carmela and I had on the thin dresses we wore for dancing parties, and were trembling with cold and excitement. Already we could hear the first whiz of the rockets as they furrowed the sky and exploded in bright colored flowers. Already the thud of old things flying out the windows could be heard, with shouts and laughter. The whole neighborhood was in an uproar, setting off firecrackers. I lighted sparklers and pinwheels for the children. I liked to see in their eyes the fearful wonder that I had felt as a child. Lila persuaded Melina to light the fuse of a Bengal light with her. The jet of flame sprayed with a colorful crackle. They shouted with joy and hugged each other. Rino, Stefano, Pasquale, Enzo, Antonio transported cases and boxes and cartons of explosives, proud of all those supplies they had managed to accumulate. Alfonso also helped, but he did it wearily, reacting to his brother's pressure with gestures of annoyance. He seemed intimidated by Rino, who was truly frenzied, pushing him rudely, grabbing things away from him, treating him like a child. So, finally, rather than get angry, Alfonso withdrew, mingling less and less with the others. Meanwhile, the matches flared as the adults lighted cigarettes for each other with cupped hands, speaking seriously and cordially. If there should be a civil war, I thought, like the one between Romulus and Remus, between Marius and Sylla, between Caesar and Pompey, they will have these same faces, these same looks, these same poses. Except for Alfonso, all the boys filled their shirts with firecrackers and missiles and arranged rows of rockets in ranks of empty bottles. Rino, increasingly agitated, shouting louder and louder, assigned to me, Lila, Ada, and Carmela the job of supplying everyone with ammunition. Then the very young, the not-so-young, my brothers Pepe and Johnny, but also my father, also the shoemaker, who was the oldest of all, began moving around in the dark and the cold, lighting fuses and throwing fireworks over the parapet or into the sky, in a celebratory atmosphere of growing excitement, of shouts like, "Did you see those colors? Wow, what a bang! Come on, come on!" All scarcely disturbed by Melina's faint yet terrified wails, by Rino as he snatched the fireworks from my brothers and used them himself, yelling that it was a waste because the boys threw them without waiting for the fuse to really catch fire. The glittering fury of the city slowly faded, died out, letting the sound of the cars, the horns, emerge. Broad zones of dark sky reappeared. The Salada's balcony became, even through the smoke, amid the flashes, more visible. They weren't far. We could see them. The father, the sons, the relatives, the friends were, like us, in the grip of a desire for chaos. The whole neighborhood knew that what had happened so far was minor. The real show would begin when the penurious had finished with their little parties and petty explosions and fine rains of silver and gold, when only the masters of the revels remained. And so it was. From the balcony, the fire intensified abruptly. The sky and the street began to explode again. At every burst, especially if the firecracker made a sound of destruction, enthusiastic obscenities came from the balcony. But, unexpectedly, here were Stefano, Pasquale, Antonio, Rino, ready to respond with more bursts and equivalent obscenities. At a rocket from the Saladas, they launched a rocket. A string of firecrackers was answered by a string of firecrackers. And in the sky, miraculous fountains erupted, and the street below flared, trembled. At one point, Rino climbed up onto the parapet, shouting insults and throwing powerful firecrackers, while his mother shrieked with terror, yelling, "Get down or you'll fall!" At that point, panic overwhelmed Melina, who began to wail. Ada was furious, It was up to her to get her home. But Alfonso indicated that he would take care of her, and he disappeared down the stairs with her. My mother immediately followed, limping, and the other women began to drag the children away. The Solado's explosions were becoming more and more violent. One of their rockets, instead of heading into the sky, burst against the parapet of our terrace with a loud red flash and suffocating smoke. "They did it on purpose," Reno yelled at Stefano, beside himself. Stefano, a dark profile in the cold, motioned him to calm down. He hurried to a corner where he himself had placed a box that we girls had received orders not to touch, and he dipped into it, inviting the others to help themselves. "Enzo," he cried, with not even a trace now of the polite shopkeeper's tones. "Pasca, Reno, Anto, here, come on, here, we'll show them what we've got." They all ran, laughing. They repeated, "Yeah, we'll let them have it. Fuck those shits. Fuck, take this." And they made obscene gestures in the direction of the Salada's balcony. Shivering with cold, we looked at their frenetic black forms. We were alone, with no role. Even my father had gone downstairs with the shoemaker. Leela, I don't know, she was silent, absorbed by the spectacle, as if by a puzzle. The thing was happening to her that I mentioned, and that she later called dissolving margins. It was, she told me, as if, on the night of a full moon over the sea, the intense black mass of a storm advanced across the sky, swallowing every light, eroding the circumference of the moon's circle, and disfiguring the shining disk, reducing it to its true nature of rough, insensate material. Leela imagined, she saw, she felt, as if it were true, her brother break. Reno, before her eyes, lost the features he had had as long as she could remember. The features of the generous, candid boy. The pleasing features of the reliable young man. The beloved outline of one who, as far back as she had memory, had amused, helped, protected her. There, amid the violent explosions, in the cold, in the smoke that burned the nostrils and the strong odor of sulfur, something violated the organic structure of her brother, exercising over him a pressure so strong that it broke down his outlines. And the matter expanded like a magma, showing her what he was truly made of. Every second of that night of celebration horrified her. She had the impression that, as Reno moved, as he expanded around himself, every margin collapsed, and her own margins, too, became softer and more yielding. She struggled to maintain control, and succeeded. On the outside, her anguish hardly showed. It's true that in the tumult of explosions and colors, I didn't pay much attention to her. I was struck, I think, by her expression, which seemed increasingly fearful. I also realized that she was staring at the shadow of her brother, the most active, the most arrogant, shouting the loudest, bloodiest insults in the direction of the Solaris Terrace, with repulsion. It seemed that she, who in general feared nothing, was afraid. But they were impressions I recalled only later. At the moment, I didn't notice. I felt closer to Carmela, to Ada, than to her. She seemed, as usual, to have no need of male attention. We, instead, out in the cold, in the midst of that chaos, without that attention, couldn't give ourselves meaning. We would have preferred that Stefano or Enzo or Reno stop the war, put an arm around our shoulders, press us to them, side to side, and speak soft words. Instead, we were holding on to each other to get warm, while they rushed to grab cylinders with fat fuses, astonished by Stefano's infinite reserves admiring of his generosity, disturbed by how much money could be transformed into fiery trails, sparks, explosions, smoke, for the pure satisfaction of winning. They competed with the Solaras for I don't know how long, explosions from one side and the other, as if the terrace and balcony were trenches, and the whole neighborhood shook, vibrated. You couldn't understand anything. Roars, shattered glass, splintered sky. Even when Enzo shouted, "They're finished! They've got nothing left!" ours continued. Reno especially kept going, until there remained not a fuse to light. Then they raised a victorious chorus, jumping and embracing. Finally, they calmed down. Silence fell. But it didn't last. It was broken by the rising cry of a child in the distance, shouts and insults, cars advancing through the streets littered with debris. And then we saw flashes on the Solara's balcony. Sharp sounds reached us. Pa! Pa! Reno shouted in disappointment. They're starting again! But Enzo, who immediately understood what was happening, pushed us inside. And after him, Pasquale, Stefano. Only Reno went on yelling vulgar insults, leaning over the parapet, so that Leela dodged Pasquale and ran to pull her brother inside, yelling insults at him in turn. We girls cried out as we went downstairs. The Solaras, in order to win, were shooting at us. 23. As I said, many things about that night escaped me. But above all, overwhelmed by the atmosphere of celebration and danger, by the swirl of males whose bodies gave off a heat hotter than the fires in the sky, I neglected Leela. And yet it was then that her first interchange took place. I didn't realize, as I said, what had happened to her. The action was difficult to perceive. But I was aware of the consequences almost immediately. She became lazier. 2 days later, I got up early, even though I didn't have school, to go with her to open the shop and help her do the cleaning. But she didn't appear. She arrived late, sullen, and we walked through the neighborhood avoiding the shoemaker's shop. "You're not going to work?" "No." "Why?" "I don't like it anymore." "And the new shoes?" "They're nowhere." And so, it seemed to me that even she didn't know what she wanted. The only definite thing was that she seemed very worried about her brother, much more than I had seen recently. And it was precisely as a result of that worry that she began to modify her speeches about wealth. There was always the pressure to become wealthy, there was no question about it. But the goal was no longer the same as in childhood. No treasure chests, no sparkle of coins and precious stones. Now, it seemed that money, in her mind, had become a cement. It consolidated, reinforced, fixed this and that. Above all, it fixed Reno's head. The pair of shoes that they had made together, he now considered ready and wanted to show them to Fernando. But Leela knew well, and according to her so did Reno, that the work was full of flaws, that their father would examine the shoes and throw them away. So she told him that they had to try and try again, that the route to the shoe factory was a difficult one. But he was unwilling to wait longer. He felt an urgent need to become like the Solaras, like Stefano, and Leela couldn't make him see reason. Suddenly, it seemed to me that wealth in itself no longer interested her. She no longer spoke of money with any excitement. It was just a means of keeping her brother out of trouble. But since it wasn't around the corner, she wondered, with cruel eyes, what she had to come up with to soothe him. Reno was in a frenzy. Fernando, for example, never reproached Leela for having stopped coming to the shop. In fact, he let her understand that he was happy for her to stay home and help her mother. Her brother instead got furious, and in early January, I witnessed another ugly quarrel. Reno approached us with his head down. He blocked our path. He said to her, "Come to work right now." Leela answered that she wouldn't think of it. He then dragged her by the arm. She defied him with a nasty insult. Reno slapped her, shouted at her, "Then go home. Go and help Mama." She obeyed, without even saying goodbye to me. The climax came on the day of Befana. She, it seems, woke up and found next to her bed a sock full of coal. She knew it was from Reno, and at breakfast she set the table for everyone but him. Her mother appeared. Reno had left a sock full of candies and chocolate hanging on a chair, which had moved her. She doted on that boy. So, when she realized that Reno's place wasn't set, she tried to set it, but Leela prevented her. While mother and daughter argued, Reno appeared, and Leela immediately threw a piece of coal at him. Reno laughed, thinking it was a game, that she had appreciated the joke. But when he realized that his sister was serious, he tried to hit her. Then Fernando arrived, in underpants and undershirt, a cardboard box in his hand. "Look what the Befana brought me," he said, and it was clear that he was furious. He pulled out of the box the new shoes that his children had made in secret. Leela was open-mouthed with surprise. She didn't know anything about it. Reno had decided on his own to show his father their work, as if it were a gift from the Befana. When she saw on her brother's face a small smile that was amused and at the same time tormented, when she caught his worried gaze on his father's face, it seemed to her she had the confirmation of what had frightened her on the terrace amid the smoke and fireworks. Reno had lost his usual outline. She now had a brother without boundaries from whom something irreparable might emerge. In that smile, in that gaze, she saw something unbearably wretched. The more unbearable, the more she loved her brother, and felt the need to stay beside him, to help him, and be helped. "How beautiful they are," said Nunzia, who was ignorant of the whole business. Fernando, without saying a word, and now looking like an angry Randolph Scott, sat down and put on first the right shoe, then the left. "The Befana," he said, "made them precisely for my feet." He got up, tried them, walked back and forth in the kitchen as his family watched. "Very comfortable," he commented. "They're gentlemen's shoes," his wife said, giving her son admiring looks. Fernando sat down again. He took them off. He examined them above, below, inside and outside. "Whoever made these shoes is a master," he said. But his face didn't brighten at all. "Brava, Befana." In every word you heard how much he suffered, and how that suffering was charging him with a desire to smash everything. But Reno didn't seem to realize it. At every sarcastic word of his father's, he became prouder. He smiled, blushing, formulated half-phrases. "I did this, Papa. I added this. I thought that." Leela wanted to get out of the kitchen, out of the way of her father's imminent rage, but she couldn't make up her mind. She didn't want to leave her brother alone. "They're light but also strong," Fernando continued. "There's no cutting corners, and I've never seen anything like them on anyone's feet. With this wide tip, they're very original." He sat down. He put them on again. He laced them. He said to his son, "Turn around, Reno. I have to thank the Befana." Reno thought it was a joke that would conclusively end the whole long controversy, and he appeared happy and embarrassed. But as soon as he started to turn his back, his father kicked him violently in the rear, called him animal, idiot, and threw at him whatever came to hand. Finally, even the shoes. Leela got involved only when she saw that her brother, at first intent only on protecting himself from punching and kicking, began shouting too, overturning chairs, breaking plates, crying, swearing that he would kill himself rather than continue to work for his father for nothing, terrorizing his mother, the other children, and the neighbors. But in vain. Father and son first had to explode until they wore themselves out. Then they went back to working together, mute, shut up in the shop with their desperations. There was no mention of the shoes for a while. Leela decided that her role was to help her mother, do the marketing, cook, wash the clothes and hang them in the sun, and she never went to the shoemaker's shop. Reno, saddened, sulky, felt the thing as an incomprehensible injustice, and began to insist that he find socks and underpants and shirt in order in his drawer, that his sister serve him and show him respect when he came home from work. If something wasn't to his liking, he protested. He said unpleasant things like, "You can't even iron a shirt, you shit." She shrugged. She didn't resist. She continued to carry out her duties with attention and care. He himself, naturally, wasn't happy with the way he was behaving. He was tormented. He tried to calm down. He made not a few efforts to return to being what he had been. On good days, Sunday mornings, for example, he wandered around joking, taking on a gentle tone of voice. "Are you mad at me because I took all the credit for the shoes?" "I did it," he said, lying, "to keep Papa from getting angry at you." And then he asked her, "Help me. What should we do now? We can't stop here. I have to get out of this situation." Leela was silent. She cooked. She ironed. At times, she kissed him on the cheek to let him know that she wasn't mad anymore. But in the meantime, he would get angry again. He always ended up smashing something. He shouted that she had betrayed him and would betray him yet again when, sooner or later, she would marry some imbecile and go away, leaving him to live in this wretchedness forever. Sometimes, when no one was home, Leela went into the little room where she had hidden the shoes and touched them, looked at them, marveled to herself that for good or ill, there they were, and had come into being as the result of a design on a sheet of graph paper. How much wasted work. 24. I returned to school. I was dragged inside the torturous rhythms that the teachers imposed on us. Many of my companions began to give up. The class thinned out. Gino got low marks and asked me to help him. I tried to, but really all he wanted was for me to let him copy my homework. I did, but reluctantly. Even when he copied, he didn't pay attention. He didn't try to understand. Even Alfonso, although he was very disciplined, had difficulties. One day, he burst into tears during the Greek interrogation, something that for a boy was considered very humiliating. It was clear that he would have preferred to die rather than shed a single tear in front of the class, but he couldn't control it. We were all silent, extremely disturbed, except Gino, who, perhaps for the satisfaction of seeing that even for his deskmate things could go badly, burst out laughing. As we left school, I told him that because of that laughter, he was no longer my boyfriend. He responded by asking me, worried, "You like Alfonso?" I explained that I simply didn't like him anymore. He stammered that we had scarcely started. It wasn't fair. Not much had happened between us as boyfriend and girlfriend. We'd kissed, but without tongues. He had tried to touch my breasts, and I had got angry and pushed him away. He begged me to continue just for a little. I was firm in my decision. I knew that it would cost me nothing to lose his company on the way to school and the way home. A few days had passed since the break with Gino, when Leela confided that she had had two declarations almost at the same time. The first in her life. Pasquale, one morning, had come up to her while she was doing the shopping. He was marked by fatigue and extremely agitated. He had said that he was worried because he hadn't seen her in the shoemaker's shop and thought she was sick. Now that he found her in good health, he was happy. But there was no happiness in his face at all as he spoke. He broke off as if he were choking, and, to free his voice, had almost shouted that he loved her. He loved her so much that, if she agreed, he would come and speak to her brother, her parents, whoever, immediately, so that they could be engaged. She was dumbstruck. For a few minutes, she thought he was joking. I had said 1,000 times that Pasquale had his eyes on her, but she had never believed me. Now there he was, on a beautiful spring day, almost with tears in his eyes, and was begging her, telling her his life was worth nothing if she said no. How difficult the sentiments of love were to untangle. Leela, very cautiously, but without ever saying no, had found words to refuse him. She had said that she loved him, but not as one should love a fiancé. She had also said that she would always be grateful to him for all the things he had explained to her. Fascism, the resistance, the monarchy, the republic, the black market, Comandante Lauro, the neo-fascists, Christian democracy, communism. But to be his girlfriend? No. She would never be anyone's girlfriend. And she had concluded, I love all of you. Antonio, you, Enzo, the way I love Reno. Pasquale had then murmured, I, however, don't love you the way I do Carmela. He had escaped and gone back to work. And the other declaration? I asked her, curious but also a little anxious. You'd never imagine. The other declaration had come from Marcello Solara. In hearing that name, I felt a pang. If Pasquale's love was a sign of how much someone could like Leela, the love of Marcello, a young man who was handsome and wealthy, with a car, who was harsh and violent, a Camorris, used, that is, to taking the women he wanted, was, in my eyes, in the eyes of all my contemporaries, and in spite of his bad reputation, in fact, perhaps even because of it, a promotion. The transition from skinny little girl to woman capable of making anyone bend to her will. How did it happen? Marcello was driving the 1100 by himself without his brother, and had seen her as she was going home along the Stradone. He hadn't driven up alongside her. He hadn't called to her from the window. He had left the car in the middle of the street, with the door open, and approached her. Leela had kept walking, and he followed. He had pleaded with her to forgive him for his behavior in the past. He admitted she would have been absolutely right to kill him with the shoemaker's knife. He had reminded her, with emotion, how they had danced rock and roll so well together at Giliola's mother's party, a sign of how well matched they might be. Finally, he had started to pay her compliments. How you've grown up, what lovely eyes you have, how beautiful you are. And then he told her a dream he had had that night. He asked her to become engaged, She said yes. He gave her an engagement ring like his grandmother's, which had 3 diamonds in the band of the setting. At last, Leela, continuing to walk, had spoken. She had asked, "In that dream, I said yes?" Marcello confirmed it, and she replied, "Then it really was a dream, because you're an animal. You and your family, your grandfather, your brother. And I would never be engaged to you, even if you tell me you'll kill me."
"You told him that?"
"I said more."
"What?"
When Marcello, insulted, had replied that his feelings were delicate, that he thought of her only with love, day and night, that therefore he wasn't an animal but one who loved her, she had responded that if a person behaved as he had behaved with Ada, if that same person on New Year's Eve started shooting people with a gun, to call him an animal was to insult animals. Marcello had finally understood that she wasn't joking, that she really considered him less than a frog, a salamander. And he was suddenly depressed. He had murmured weakly, "It was my brother who was shooting." But even as he spoke, he had realized that that excuse would only increase her contempt. Very true. Leela had started walking faster, and when he tried to follow, had yelled, "Go away!" and started running. Marcello then had stopped as if he didn't remember where he was and what he was supposed to be doing. And so he had gone back to the 1100.
"You did that to Marcello Solara?"
"Yes."
"You're crazy. Don't tell anyone you treated him like that."
At the moment, it seemed to me superfluous advice. I said it just to demonstrate that I was concerned. Leela, by nature, liked talking and fantasizing about facts, but she never gossiped, unlike the rest of us, who are continuously talking about people. And in fact, she spoke only to me of Pasquale's love. I never discovered that she had told anyone else. But she told everyone about Marcello Solara. So that when I saw Carmela, she said, "Did you know that your friend said no to Marcello Solara?" I met Ada, who said to me, "Your friend said no to Marcello Solara, no less." Pinuccio Caracci, in the shop, whispered in my ear, "Is it true that your friend said no to Marcello Solara?" Even Alfonso said to me one day at school, astonished, "Your friend said no to Marcello Solara?" When I saw Leela, I said to her, "You shouldn't have told everyone. Marcello will get angry." She shrugged. She had work to do. Her siblings, the housework, her mother, her father, and she didn't stop to talk much. Now, as she had been since New Year's Eve, she was occupied only with domestic things. 25. So it was. For the rest of the term, Leela was totally uninterested in what I did in school. And when I asked her what books she was taking out of the library, what she was reading, she answered, spitefully, "I don't take them out anymore. Books give me a headache." Whereas I studied, reading now was like a pleasant habit. But I soon had to observe that, since Leela had stopped pushing me, anticipating me in my studies and my reading, school, and even Maestro Ferraro's library, had stopped being a kind of adventure, and had become only a thing that I knew how to do well and was much praised for. I realized this clearly on 2 occasions. Once I went to get some books out of the library. My card was dense with borrowings and returns, and the teacher first congratulated me on my diligence, then asked me about Leela, showing regret that she and her whole family had stopped taking out books. It's hard to explain why, but that regret made me suffer. It seemed to be the sign of a true interest in Leela, something much stronger than the compliments for my discipline as a constant reader. It occurred to me that if Leela had taken out just a single book a year, on that book she would have left her imprint, and the teacher would have felt it the moment she returned it. While I left no mark, I embodied only the persistence with which I added volume to volume in no particular order. The other circumstance had to do with school exercises. The literature teacher, Geraci, gave back, corrected, our Italian papers. I still remember the subject, the various phases of the tragedy of Dido. And while he generally confined himself to saying a word or two to justify the 8 or 9 I usually got, this time he praised me eloquently in front of the class, and revealed only at the end that he had given me a 10. At the end of the class, he called me into the corridor, truly impressed by how I had treated the subject. And when the religion teacher came by, he stopped him and summarized my paper enthusiastically. A few days passed, and I realized that Geraci had not limited himself to the priest, but had circulated that paper of mine among the other teachers, and not only in my section. Some teachers in the upper grades now smiled at me in the corridors, or even made comments. For example, Professor Galliani, a woman who was highly regarded and yet avoided, because she was said to be a communist, and because with 1 or 2 comments she could dismantle any argument that did not have a solid foundation, stopped me in the hall and spoke with particular admiration about the idea, central to my paper, that if love is exiled from cities, their good nature becomes an evil nature. She asked me, "What does a city without love mean to you?" "A people deprived of happiness. Give me an example." I thought of the discussions I'd had with Leela and Pasquale in September, and I suddenly felt that they were a true school, truer than the one I went to every day. Italy under fascism, Germany under Nazism, all of us human beings in the world today. She scrutinized me with increased interest. She said that I wrote very well. She recommended some reading. She offered to lend me books. Finally, she asked me what my father did. I answered, "He's a porter at the city hall." She went off with her head down. The interest shown by Professor Galliani naturally filled me with pride, but it had no great consequence. The school routine returned to normal. As a result, even the fact that in my first year I was a student with a small reputation for being clever soon seemed to me unimportant. In the end, what did it prove? It proved how fruitful it had been to study with Leela and talk to her, to have her as a goad and support as I ventured into the world outside the neighborhood, among the things and persons and landscapes and ideas of books. "Of course," I said to myself, "the essay on Dido is mine. The capacity to formulate beautiful sentences comes from me. Of course, what I wrote about Dido belongs to me." But didn't I work it out with her? Didn't we excite each other in turn? Didn't my passion grow in the warmth of hers? And that idea of the city without love, which the teachers had liked so much, hadn't it come to me from Leela, even if I had developed it with my own ability? What should I deduce from this? I began to expect new praise that would prove my autonomous virtuosity. But Geraci, when he gave another assignment on the Queen of Carthage, Aeneas and Dido, an encounter between two refugees, was not enthusiastic. He gave me only an 8. Still, from Professor Galliani, I got cordial nods of greeting, and the pleasant discovery that she was the Latin and Greek teacher of Nino Saratori. I urgently needed some reinforcements of attention and admiration, and hoped that maybe they would come from him. I hoped that, if his professor of literature had praised me in public, let's say in his class, he would remember me and finally would speak to me. But nothing happened. I continued to glimpse him on the way out, on the way in, always with that absorbed expression, never a glance. Once I even followed him along Corso Garibaldi and Via Casanova, hoping he would notice me and say, "Hello, I see we're taking the same route. I've heard a lot about you." But he walked quickly, eyes down, and never turned. I got tired. I despised myself. Depressed, I turned on to Corso Navarro and went home. I kept on day after day, committed to asserting with increasing thoroughness to the teachers, to my classmates, to myself, my application and diligence. But inside, I felt a growing sense of solitude. I felt I was learning without energy. I tried to report to Lila Maestro Ferraro's regret. I told her to go back to the library. I also mentioned to her how well the assignment on Dido had been received, without telling her what I had written, but letting her know that it was also her success. She listened to me without interest. Maybe she no longer even remembered what we had said about that character. She had other problems. As soon as I left her in opening, she told me that Marcello Solara had not resigned himself like Pasquale, but continued to pursue her. If she went out to do the shopping, he followed her, without bothering her, to Stefano's store, to Enzo's cart, just to look at her. If she went to the window, she found him at the corner, waiting for her to appear. This constancy made her anxious. She was afraid that her father might notice, and especially that Rino might notice. She was frightened by the possibility that one of those stories of men would begin, in which they would end up fighting all the time. There were plenty of those in the neighborhood. "What do I have?" she said. She saw herself as scrawny, ugly. Why had Marcello become obsessed with her? "Is there something wrong with me?" she said. "I make people do the wrong thing." Now she often repeated that idea. The conviction of having done more harm than good for her brother had solidified. "All you have to do is look at him," she said. Even with the disappearance of the Cerullo shoe factory project, Rino was gripped by the mania of getting rich like the Solaras, like Stefano, and even more, and he couldn't resign himself to the dailiness of the work in the shop. He said, trying to rekindle her old enthusiasm, "We're intelligent, Lena. Together, no one can stop us. Tell me what we should do." He also wanted to buy a car, a television, and he detested Fernando, who didn't understand the importance of these things. And when Lilo showed that she wouldn't support him anymore, he treated her worse than a servant. Maybe he didn't even know that he had changed for the worse, but she, who saw him every day, was alarmed. She said to me once, "Have you seen that when people wake up, they're ugly, all disfigured, can't see?" Rino, in her view, had become like that. 26. One Sunday, in the middle of April, I remember five of us went out, Lila, Carmela, Pasquale, Rino, and I. We girls were dressed up as well as we could, and as soon as we were out of the house, we put on lipstick and a little eye makeup. We took the metro, which was very crowded, and Rino and Pasquale stood next to us, on the lookout the whole way. They were afraid that someone might touch us, but no one did. The faces of our escorts were too dangerous. We walked down Toledo, Leela insisted on going to Via Caia, Via Filangieri, and then Via dei Mille, to Piazza Amedeo, an area where she knew there would be wealthy, elegant people. Rino and Pasquale were opposed, but they couldn't or wouldn't explain, and responded only by muttering in dialect and insulting indeterminate people they called dandies. We three ganged up and insisted. Just then we heard honking. We turned and saw the Salata's 1100. We didn't even notice the two brothers. We were so struck by the girls who were waving from the windows. Giliola and Ada. They looked pretty, with pretty dresses, pretty hairdos, sparkling earrings. They waved and shouted happy greetings to us. Rino and Pasquale turned their faces away. Carmela and I were too surprised to respond. Leela was the only one to shout enthusiastically and wave with broad motions of her arms as the car disappeared in the direction of Piazza Plebiscito. For a while we were silent. Then Rino said to Pasquale that he had always known that Giliola was a whore, and Pasquale gravely agreed. Neither of the two mentioned Ada. Antonio was their friend, and they didn't want to offend him. Carmela, however, said a lot of mean things about Ada. More than anything, I felt bitterness. That image of power had passed in a flash, four young people in a car. That was the right way to leave the neighborhood and have fun. Ours was the wrong way, on foot, in shabby old clothes, penniless. I felt like going home. Leela reacted as if that encounter had never taken place, insisting again that she wanted to go for a walk where the fancy people were. She clung to Pasquale's arm. She yelled. She laughed. She performed what she thought of as a parody of the respectable person, with waggling hips, a broad smile, and simpering gestures. We hesitated a moment, and then went along with her, resentful at the idea that Giliola and Ada were having fun in the 1100 with the handsome Solaras while we were on foot, in the company of Rino, who resold shoes, and Pasquale, who was a construction worker. This dissatisfaction of ours, naturally unspoken, must somehow have reached the two boys, who looked at each other, sighed, and gave in. All right, they said, and we turned onto Via Caia. It was like crossing a border. I remember a dense crowd and a sort of humiliating difference. I looked not at the boys, but at the girls, the women. They were absolutely different from us. They seemed to have breathed another air, to have eaten other food, to have dressed on some other planet, to have learned to walk on wisps of wind. I was astonished. All the more so that, while I would have paused to examine at leisure dresses, shoes, the style of glasses if they wore glasses, they passed by without seeming to see me. They didn't see any of the five of us. We were not perceptible. Or not interesting. And in fact, if at times their gaze fell on us, they immediately turned in another direction, as if irritated. They looked only at each other. Of this we were all aware. No one mentioned it, but we understood that Rino and Pasquale, who were older, found on those streets only confirmation of things they already knew. And this put them in a bad mood, made them sullen, resentful at the certainty of being out of place. While we girls discovered it only at that moment, and with ambiguous sentiments. We felt uneasy, and yet fascinated. Ugly, but also impelled to imagine what we would become if we had some way to re-educate ourselves and dress and put on makeup and adorn ourselves properly. Meanwhile, in order not to ruin the evening, We became mocking, sarcastic.
Would you ever wear that dress? Not if you paid me.
I would.